tonight I want to pick up where we left off in the book of Isaiah. We left off in chapter 38, and because we've been out of town, we haven't had this study for a couple weeks. So anyway, just a way of brief background, especially since there's a few new people who are here tonight that weren't here when we read about this chapter 37. Just a real brief background about this. This is a time in Israel's history, or basically Judah's history, the southern tribe, where the Assyrian army is coming down, and they're coming down with just a tremendous force, and they're just overrunning one village after another, after another, after another, and they are coming up against Jerusalem, and they're going to destroy Jerusalem. And Hezekiah had made every kind of overture he possibly could to the king of Assyria to buy him off, and it didn't work. And long story short, Hezekiah finally, when he got his back against the wall and he had nowhere to go but down on his knees and nowhere to look but up, and he really began to seek God in prayer about this whole situation, then God spoke to him through his prophet Isaiah and said that, look, the king of Assyria is not going to even come here and shoot an arrow, because I'm going to take care of him myself. And God, the angel of the Lord, went through the camp of the Assyrians that night and killed 185,000 of them. And then what was left of the Assyrian army was practically nothing. And so the king of Assyria went back to Assyria with his tail between his legs. And he ended up being murdered by one of his own sons while he was worshiping one of his gods in his pagan temple. And so that's what we're picking up here. But what's interesting is when we're reading this chapter 38, we read about a situation where Hezekiah is dying. Now, when you read the whole context here, you understand that he's dying at a time when the Assyrians are threatening him, threatening to overrun Jerusalem. I mean, the old saying, when it rains, it pours. I mean, this is what's happening to this guy. One major problem after another after another. And this chapter 38 in the book of Isaiah, and it's also recorded in 2 Kings chapter 20, in my opinion, tells of one of the most fantastic and incredible miracles that you will ever read anywhere. I mean, it just really boggles the mind and staggers the imagination when you look at the miracle that takes place here in the healing of Hezekiah. But beginning with verse 1 in chapter 38 of Isaiah, it says, "In those days Hezekiah became mortally ill, and Isaiah the prophet, the son of Amos, came to him and said to him, 'Thus saith the Lord, set your house in order, for you shall die and not live.' Then Hezekiah turned his face to the wall and prayed to the Lord and said, 'Remember now, O Lord, I beseech you, how I have walked before you in truth and with a whole heart, and have done what is good in your sight.' And Hezekiah wept bitterly. Then the word of the Lord came to Isaiah, saying, 'Go and say to Hezekiah, thus saith the Lord, the God of your fathers, I have heard your prayer, I have seen your tears. Behold, I will add 15 years to your life. I will deliver you and this city from the hand of the king of Assyria, and I will defend this city.'" Now, this is what I was talking about, that this was at a time when the Assyrians were threatening. This wasn't after it happened. This was right during this time. And in verse 7 it says, "This shall be the sign for you from the Lord, that the Lord will do this thing that he has spoken. Behold, I will cause the shadow on the stairway which has gone down with the sun on the stairway of Ahaz to go back 10 steps. So the sun's shadow went back 10 steps on the stairway on which it had gone down. Now, before we go any further, what I want to do is, before we get into this prayer, I want to jump down to this verse 21 before we come back to Hezekiah's prayer. Because in verse 21 it says, "Now Isaiah had said, 'Let them take a cake of figs and apply it to the boil, that he may recover.' Then Hezekiah said, 'What is the sign that I shall go up to the house of the Lord?'" Now, I just want to back up here just for a minute, because this is also recorded in this 2 Kings chapter 20. We went through there. But I want to break this down on what's happening in his life, because it says here he became mortally ill. Now, I don't know what kind of illness he had. And I'm looking over here when it said that he had, in that verse 21, he had a boil that he put some kind of ointment upon it, some kind of ointment made of figs on this boil. And I'm just wondering, if it's a boil inside, then you put ointment over it. It's one of those things you just kind of, wonder, well, how does that work? I don't know. All I'm saying is, we're a few thousand years removed from this, 2,700 years removed from what happened here. But to me, it kind of raises a few questions on exactly what kind of illness he had. But for sure, he was dying. And I'm sure that he probably asked the prophet Isaiah if he was going to get well. And Isaiah said, no, you're going to die. Get your house in order, you're going to die. And I think that's good advice. Read that verse 1 again in chapter 38 of Isaiah. In those days, Hezekiah became mortally ill, and Isaiah the prophet, the son of Amos, came to him and said to him, thus saith the Lord, set your house in order. Now, who's saying this to Hezekiah? I just read it.
Huh? Isaiah is saying that the Lord says
this. It's God who's telling this king, get your house in order, for you shall die and not live. Now, that's pretty profound to me, don't you think? And I think that this is God's message to everyone. It really is to everyone, especially if a person has a terminal illness and they are on their deathbed and they are dying. God is saying to them, get your house in order. Now, granted, you could say, well, you know, I got to make sure they got a will made out, and I got to make sure that whatever kind of inheritance I'm going to pass on goes to the right people, and I've got to make sure that all of my finances are taken care of and all this type of thing. But when God is saying, get your house in order, I mean, it's twofold. One is, of course, to make your preparation so you're going to die in this world and what needs to be done. But the most important thing is, hey, man, get your house in order spiritually. And what amazes me is the number of people that are on their deathbed and they never turn to God. They never turn to God in prayer. They never seek Him in prayer. I mean, it truly is amazing to me. I've been in and out of hospitals, in and out of hospices, in and out of places where people are just, they're standing at death's door. They're at the very threshold of the grave and they spend their life just simply slouched in a chair and watching TV. Or gazing mindlessly out of a window, or they're just vegetating. And now I can't be anybody's judge, but I do think that's a powerful message, because there's so many people today who, even at death's door, they don't, you know, get their house in order. Now, here's a situation. I've said this many times going through the Bible when we're reading different accounts or different chapters, different books. And one of the most intriguing things, one of the biggest mysteries or enigmas in the Bible to me, is the fact that you've got two thieves dying at the right hand and the left hand of Jesus Christ, and they're both suffering the exact same punishment, the exact same pain, the exact same sentence of death. They're both going through the exact same agony. And one of them finally has an epiphany, and he just turns to Jesus Christ and says, man, remember me when you come into your kingdom. And the other one, apparently he died blaspheming, and apparently he's still blaspheming tonight. I mean, is that a mystery to you? I just can't help but think, well, what's wrong with that guy on the left? Because, first of all, they both started mocking Jesus Christ. We are told that in the Gospels. But then the one on the right, he reads undoubtedly the sign over Jesus' head saying, Jesus Nazareth, King of the Jews. But also, keep this in mind, you couldn't live in Palestine at that particular time without having heard of Jesus Christ. He was a legend in his own time. I mean, everybody was talking about him. So no doubt in my mind that both these thieves have heard a lot about Jesus. But then the one really begins to look at Christ, and he really begins to have a change of heart. He figures, man, I'm going to die. I want to meet God. And so he just throws, you know, everything upon Jesus Christ. In a sense, this thief was a thief into the end, because he stole heaven by just putting his faith in Jesus Christ. But it's the other guy that just mystifies me. Why wasn't he moved? Why didn't he get his house in order? That's a solemn message, and that's what God is saying to Hezekiah here. But now look what Hezekiah does in this verse 2 of chapter 38 of Isaiah. It says, then Hezekiah turned his face to the wall and prayed to the Lord and said, remember now, O Lord, I beseech you, how I have walked before you in truth and with a whole heart, and have done what is good in your sight. And Hezekiah wept bitterly. Now, Hezekiah, it was a real blow to him, because he really did try to make some reforms in Israel and really try to turn people's hearts back to God. But God said, get your house in order, you're going to die. And then he just really protests what's happening to him. Now, here's the thing. God is compassionate. He's merciful. And he hears Hezekiah's prayer. And then he's gracious to him, and he answers his prayer. But when we read on further on, especially when we went into the book of Kings, I really think Hezekiah probably would have been better off to just saying, Lord, not my will, but your will be done. Now, why do I say that?
He had birth to a son that
ended up being the worst king of Israel, Manasseh.
Yes, that's exactly what happened, because we are actually, and what I read in Josephus' account, he said that one of the reasons why Hezekiah was so distraught is because he didn't have a son at this particular time, and he didn't have anyone to pass on his name, and Hezekiah was in his prime. I mean, you know, he was middle-aged, and he just felt like, man, I just don't want to die, period. Now, everybody can relate to that. I mean, most people can relate to what Hezekiah is saying here. But in a sense, I think Hezekiah would have probably been better off if he said, Lord, this is just devastating to me. It's just devastating. But, you know, Lord, I'll just accept it. I just accept it. I believe that you are too wise to make mistakes. And you're too good to be unkind. And I just ask that you be gracious and merciful to me and take me home in peace. Now, I think that would have been a better prayer. But, of course, I'm sitting here in a comfortable living room with perfect health, and I'm not in that situation, so it's easy to be an armchair quarterback. But all I'm saying is this. God knew what he was doing. And nevertheless, Hezekiah moved God's heart to change his mind, and he added 15 years to his life. Unfortunately, during that 15 years, he begat a son named Manasseh, who reigned for 55 years, and he completely undid every reform that his father Hezekiah had made. And Manasseh was the worst king of Judah. He was the worst king of the southern tribe of Israel. He just instituted all kinds of sorcery and witchcraft, and because of him there was all kinds of bloodshed and crime, and he just completely ruined everything that his father had done. And it was because of Manasseh that basically the people really got behind all of his wickedness, and then God was going to judge the entire southern tribe because of that. And you know, when we read in Kings, we read about Manasseh where he actually repented when God just judged him severely. God had him dragged off to Babylon, believe it or not, and he's in prison in Babylon, and then he repents. You know, he's the worst king of the southern tribe of Israel, but he repented from all of his wickedness, believe it or not. And he probably repented because of the godliness of his father. It kind of came back to him. And he repented when things really got bad for him. But the problem is, he put into motion so much wickedness, and the people really desired that. And so even though he repented, the nation didn't, and then it brought tremendous judgment upon them. So anyway, this is what God says in this verse 4. It says, then the word of the Lord came to Isaiah, saying, go and say to Hezekiah, thus saith the Lord God of your father David, I have heard your prayer, I have seen your tears. Behold, I will add 15 years to your life. I will deliver you and this city from the hand of the king of Assyria, and I will defend this city. Now see, that's what I'm saying. This is at the time when he's being attacked. So it's really coming down around his ears, right? This isn't after the fact. This isn't after the Assyrians were slain. This was just before it, just prior to it. And then verse 7, this shall be the sign to you from the Lord, that the Lord will do this thing that he has spoken. Behold, I will cause the shadow of the stairway which has gone down with the sun on the stairway of Ahaz to go back 10 steps. So the sun's shadow went back 10 steps on the stairway on which it had gone down. Now, this to me is the most incredible miracle that you will read in the Bible, unless you're going to include the resurrection of Jesus Christ, because this miracle, in my opinion, I looked at it from every which angle, and I can't help but believe that you know how God turned back time, because when you turn back that shadow on that sundial, apparently it's about 40 minutes. So there's only one conceivable way that you could turn back time. And that's, you've got to reverse the universe. You have to put everything that's in motion, you've got to put it in reverse. In other words, we set our watches and we calculate our calendars by the stars, by the galaxies, by the planets, by the movement of this universe. Now, just bear with me on this, okay? Because I'm in the process of writing another book. It's titled 101 Insights for the Soul. And this is just one chapter of the 101 Insights. And this chapter is titled The Universe Thrown into Reverse. And it goes, just how powerful is God? Exactly how almighty is he? Have you ever asked yourself these questions or wondered about the potency of God? Well, the truth is that his power is so far beyond our human comprehension that our finite minds are utterly incapable of wrapping our intellect around it. That is why faith is so absolutely essential in our relationship with him. It is so all important that God himself says whatever is not of faith is sin, and that without faith it is impossible to please God, Hebrews 11:6, and that we cannot be saved apart from faith, Hebrews 2:8. However, it is not unintelligible faith. It is not faith that is stupid, blind, or gullible. It is faith that is based on reason, and yet it still boils down to the assurance of things hoped for and the conviction of things not seen, Hebrews 11. Just look at the vastness of our universe and everything it contains, and it is truly mind-boggling. And then to believe that it all came into being out of nothing, who can comprehend that? No one, absolutely no one. That is why God places such a premium on faith, and even goes as far as equating faith with righteousness, Genesis 15. With this thought in mind, imagine sitting in a cosmic stadium where we are about to witness the most incredible miracle that this universe has ever experienced. It is so unbelievable that if we were eyewitnesses to this event, we still would not believe it. Our limited minds would immediately scramble to try to minimize or deny or explain away just what transpired before our eyes. We would desperately attempt to refute or disavow what we just observed, because our restricted intelligence would tell us that no one, not even God, could be so powerful. This miracle is recorded in 2 Kings chapter 20 and Isaiah chapter 38. It was when King Hezekiah was dying and pleaded to God for his life. Moved with compassion, God sent his prophet Isaiah to him and told him that he would recover from his sickness. And as a confirmation, Hezekiah asked what sign God would give him. Isaiah asked Hezekiah if he wanted the shadow of Ahaz's sundial to go back 10 steps or forward 10 steps. Hezekiah said that it was nothing for the shadow of the sundial to go advance 10 degrees or 40 minutes, but to make it go back 40 minutes, and so it did. Slowly the shadow retreated 10 steps. Unless we simply convince ourselves that God moved the shadow like a man would move a chess piece or the hands on a clock, then what we are witnessing is truly beyond human comprehension. Our earth is spinning on its axis at 1,000 miles an hour. It is revolving around the sun at 67,000 miles an hour. Our galaxy is moving 1,000,000 miles per hour, and our universe is expanding at a velocity that now exceeds the speed of light. We set our watches and calculate our calendars by the rotation of the earth and the positions of the stars and the movements of the heavens. Now, for the shadow of Ahaz's sundial to go back 10 degrees, it means that the entire universe would have to be thrown into reverse, yet no one so much as felt it. If you are in a vehicle that is traveling 67,000 miles an hour and are instantly thrown into reverse, the kinetic energy of your forward motion will catapult you right through the windshield and into next week or to the moon. So, to reverse time or to move the sundial back 40 minutes required a power that cannot be understood or comprehended. For anyone to simply say that the movement of the stars and the planets were not involved in this miracle, they are forgetting what happened in the days of Joshua when he asked God to make the time stand still so that he and his men would have the sunlight they needed in order to defeat their enemies. Quote, this is what it says in Joshua 9. It says, O sun, stand still at Gibeon, O moon in the valley of Ajalon. So the sun stood still and the moon stopped until the nation avenged themselves on their enemies. And the sun stopped in the middle of the sky and did not hasten to go down for about a whole day. There was no day like it before it or after it. And that's in Joshua. What kind of power is that? The power to stop the movement of the stars and even reverses the motion in order to suspend time or turn back the clock. It's the same power that stopped the wind and halted the kinetic motion of the waves in the Sea of Galilee, Mark 4. When the apostles witnessed it, they said, what manner of man is this that even the wind and the waves obey him? The same question can be asked, what manner of God is this that even the stars and the planets obey him? This same God who became the same man on the Sea of Galilee will someday make the entire universe disappear in his presence. Quote, then I saw the great white throne and he who sat upon it, and from whose presence the earth and the heavens fled away and no place was found for them, Revelation 20. Power that can create this universe, stop the motion of this universe, and reverse the movement of this universe, and then make this universe vanish, is power beyond all understanding. No wonder faith is so essential in knowing God, because his power blinds us. So the next time you look at your watch, know for certain that it is possible to turn back time, but only the power of an all-powerful God can accomplish this impossible feat. And know without question that it is this almighty being who created the incredible space-time continuum, and who can control it and dissolve it with just a word. Now, I hope I didn't bore you with that, but I just wanted to distill down what is involved in this miracle, because to me, I just cannot believe that God just simply moved that shadow back like he would a chess piece. or move the hands of a clock back. He had reversed the whole motion of the universe. And if people say, well, I don't believe that, he had to move just the shadow. Well, then you got to explain, well, how come in Joshua we read about a situation where God stopped the whole motion of the universe for a whole day, about a whole day? You see, that's not moving any shadow now, is it? That's just stopping everything. Now, God just, he stopped it in Joshua, the movement of everything, as far as the stars and the planets and the galaxies, the sun and everything else. But here, he reverses it. So this is even a greater miracle. All right, even though this is 40 minutes and Joshua's was about a day, this is in reverse now, and nobody feels it. This miracle is just beyond comprehension. It really is. Now, the unfortunate thing is I have read in three different accounts. One of them was How to Live Like a King's Son, and another one was the Terrabilla news clipping that I clipped out, and another one was, I forget, it was some science book that I had read. And in three different accounts, I had read a situation where people have said in their writings that there was a time in NASA's history where they were trying to calculate the movements of the stars and the planets and whatnot. And long story short, they ran all kinds of things, calculations through their computers, and they came up a day short. And they didn't understand, well, how can it be a day short? And they had some guy supposedly on their team that said, well, you know, in the Bible it talks about a missing day. And they said, well, where's that? So he brought them back to the book of Joshua where he showed them. But they were still like 40 minutes shy of this day. And he says, well, I read in Isaiah and I read in Kings where there was about 40 minutes. And so they confirmed this supposedly and put it in their calculations and whatnot. I want to tell you right now, that's all urban legend. That's all myth. That's all fake. That's all phony. I read it in three different accounts. And it's unfortunate that Christians sometimes buy into this kind of stuff because it only makes us look foolish in the eyes of the scientific community when they come up with this kind of urban legend. And I only throw that out here because we're dealing with this here, and I'm saying, take it for what it's saying. What I think happened here is that God threw the universe in reverse. All right. Now, maybe I'm wrong, but I'm reading it, and it sure seems like that's the case to me.
I would tend to agree with you, John. And the thing that really helps me to believe it and to see it and to understand it to some degree is just as the concept of God is the God of the universe, he's the creator of all things present, that he can create life, that he can do all these things that he's done. For him to turn back time, to me, is not an unbelievable kind of thing if he was a creator of time.
Yeah, we're talking about miracles that boggle the mind, stagger the imagination. So that's why I am saying that faith is so important in our relationship with God. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yes.
Because his power blinds us. That's why God puts such a premium on faith. Because when you see his power, it just blinds us. It really does, right? Now, what I want to do is I want to read now, go back to verse 9. I want to read what Isaiah wrote here. And then it says here in verse 9 of 38 of Isaiah, it says this: a writing of Hezekiah, king of Judah, after his illness and recovery. I said in the middle of my life, I am to enter the gates of Sheol. Now, Sheol, it's a name for the netherworld. It's a name for the grave. And in this context, he's talking about the grave, but it also could stand for hell. But here he's talking about the grave. I am to enter the gates of Sheol, or the grave. I am to be deprived of the rest of my years. I said, I will not see the Lord in the land of the living. I will look on man no more among the inhabitants of the world. Like a shepherd's tent, my dwelling is pulled up and removed from me. As a weaver, I rolled up my life. He cut me off from the loom, and day and till night you make an end of me. I compose my soul until morning, like a lion, so he breaks all of my bones. From day until night you make an end of me, like a swallow, like a crane, so I twitter. I moan like a dove, my eyes look wistfully to the heights. O Lord, I am oppressed, be my security. What shall I say? For he has spoken to me, and he himself has done it. I will wander about all my years because of the bitterness of my soul. O Lord, by these things men live, and in all these is the life of my spirit. O restore me to health, and let me live. Lo, for my own welfare I had great bitterness. It is you who has kept my soul from the pit of nothingness, for you have cast all my sins behind your back. For Sheol cannot thank you, death cannot praise you, those who go down to the pit cannot hope for your faithfulness. It is the living who give thanks to you, as I do today. A father tells his son about your faithfulness. The Lord will surely save me, so we will play my songs on stringed instruments all the days of our life at the house of the Lord. Now, I just want to make a couple brief comments about what Hezekiah had written here. And if I'm not mistaken, you won't find this written in 2 Kings where you find this account of his healing. But he wrote this, and he says a couple things here I just want to say, just highlight in passing. Because he says this in this verse 17. He says, "Lo, for my life welfare I had great bitterness. It is you who have kept my soul from the pit of nothingness, for you have cast my sins behind your back." Now, I just want to make a comment on this, because when he says the pit of nothingness, he's talking about the grave here, but he's not talking about a situation where you become nothing, you're non-existent, because the Jehovah Witnesses like to take off on a verse like this and say, see, this is soul sleep. See, God is going to raise the righteous someday, but then the wicked are just going to go into nothingness, and so is the devil and all the demons and stuff like that. Well, that's not what it's saying at all. But what it is saying is this, that as far as if a person is in a grave, they have nothing more to do in this life. They have nothing more to do with this life. And in this life, they can never praise and thank God again. See, that's what it's talking about. It says nothingness. I mean, just go by any grave and you will, you know, the silence is deafening. And that silence is nothingness. These people have nothing more to say and nothing more to do in this life, especially when it comes to praising or thanking God in this life. And then he says in verse 18, "For Sheol cannot thank you." Now, Sheol is the grave where you're there. Death cannot praise you. All right? When you die, we're no longer going to be praising God in this life. It doesn't mean that our souls are not going to be in heaven praising God. He says, "Those who go down to the pit cannot hope for your faithfulness." Now, the pit he's talking about here is not the pit of hell, but he's talking about the netherworld. He's talking about they go down to the grave, all right, as far as this life is concerned. He says, "It is the living who give thanks to you, as I do today." And, of course, he's talking about people who are on this planet, in this world, that are living and breathing, to give praise to God. But also the spiritual application is that the living, it talks about spiritually speaking. So a person who's in heaven, they're living. All right, just like people in hell, they're very much conscious, but they are referred to as the dead, the damned. Mm-hmm. And it says, "A father tells his son about your faithfulness. The Lord will surely save me, so we will play my songs on my stringed instruments all the days of our life at the house of the Lord." So he's basically saying this, that if the Lord's going to heal him, he's going to be, you know, at the house of the Lord, at the temple of the Lord, and praising and thanking him and giving him glory and giving him honor. Now, I just want to say one more thing before we move on to this chapter 39. 39 is only 8 verses, and it'd be quick to get through this. But I want to make this comment about this verse 21, where it says, "Now Isaiah said, let them take a cake of figs and apply it to the boil, that he may recover. Then Hezekiah had said, what is the sign that I shall go up to the house of the Lord?" So when he says, take this cake of figs, I mean, here's the thing. What I find very interesting is that Isaiah didn't say to him, well, be healed. He said, take this ointment and put it on to boil. So there was some kind of medicine there. All right, but God is the divine healer. He was the one who really does the healing. But he's given us herbs. He's given us all of these different types of medications. And I think a person who claims to believe in God is really, really foolish if they just feel like, well, I'm just going to, you know, ignore going to the doctor or ignore taking any kind of medication or any kind of treatment because God is going to heal me. I just do not think that shows a great deal of common sense. You know, now granted, if God heals you, then there's no point in taking any of your medicine, but I wouldn't flush it down the toilet until you're healed. You know what I mean? I'll tell you, this has been a year for injuries for me, for example. It really has. I mean, I can't believe it. At the beginning of the year, I was jogging in the rain one day and just, you know, I was just soaking wet, and it was just I had some really bad shoes on, and I did something to my back. I really did. And for two months, I was in pain. But I was praying every day, God would heal me. I would pray every day because I was really in a lot of pain. I think it was my sciatic, you know, that I had I don't know if I ruptured a disc or something, and it just pressed on that nerve. Anyway, long story short, I went to the doctor, and I was taking some ibuprofen over the counter, you know, whatever it is. But I did everything I could medically, but I also realized, hey, God, it's God. He's going to heal me. And then he healed me. And then right after that, I blew out my shoulder. For 2 months, I've been going through that. You know, I push myself like I'm 20, 30 years old, and then, you know, I end up injuring myself. It takes a long time to heal. But I pray for healings, and I use the medication. Anyway, anybody have anyone to add or share? Yeah.
Well, I was going to say, just back to the Hezekiah on his deathbed. I mean, a couple things. One, I think it just shows the supreme power of prayer. Like, it's a great example of, you know, and I think we pray, but our prayers are faithless. You know, he had a lot of faith, and just along that faith that he, though he was on his deathbed, he didn't spite God or turn his heart on God.
Right.
He kept his faith, and he prayed in earnestness. And I think, you know, a lot of times when we're suffering, people turn away from God in those times because they think God is evil or bad, or, you know, has forgotten them, but he knows better.
Right. Hezekiah did not become bitter, resentful, angry with God. Look at that, verse 10. It said here, I said, in the middle of my life, I am to enter the gates of Sheol. I am to be deprived of the rest of my years. But he didn't curse God. Right? Instead, he seeks God in prayer, and you analyze his prayer and the essence of his prayer. If you distill it down, you know what he's basically saying? He's saying, look, God, let me live because I want to live to praise you, to glorify you, to thank you, because I will not be able to do that in the grave. That's his prayer. Mm-hmm. And the guy knew how to pray, because that was it in a nutshell, right? And God heard his prayer and saved. Okay, I'd like to just read this chapter 39. It's only 8 verses. Don't anybody panic. We still got time.
This, okay. To set it up, you mentioned it would have been better for Hezekiah to say, your will, God, not mine. This is the second thing, I think, that he did during his time.
Well, but here's the thing, too, all right? Yeah, he didn't do that, okay? He didn't do that. But here's the thing, that I always try to pray in that vein. I always try to say, Lord, let your perfect will be done. Now, I've heard people say, especially people who are in a name it and claim it crowd, who are in a health, wealth, and prosperity, some of them, they just feel like, well, you never want to pray, thy will be done, because it shows a lack of faith. And I say, just the opposite, because, you know, look at Jesus Christ, the way he prayed that prayer. He was agonizing. He was begging his Father, is there any other way? Let this cup pass from me, but not my will, but thy will be done. And when a person says, look, this doesn't make any sense. It's just really painful. It's just really disappointing. But I trust you explicitly. I believe you're too wise to make mistakes. I believe you're too good to be unkind. Now, does that glorify God? It's got to glorify God. Okay, let's just move on. We're going to read this chapter 39 of Isaiah and close for tonight. Like I said, it's only 8 verses, but this is what it says. Verse 1, it says, at that time, Merodach Bal Laden, son of Baladan, the king of Babylon, sent letters and a present to Hezekiah, for he had heard that he had been sick and he had recovered. And Hezekiah was pleased and showed them all of his treasure house, the silver and the gold and the spices and the precious oil and his whole armory and all that was found in his treasuries. And there was nothing in his house nor in all of his dominion that Hezekiah did not show them. Now, before we go any further, I just want to make a comment on this, because if you read the account in 2 Kings chapter 20 about this healing of Hezekiah. In this Isaiah, it talks about this Merodach Baladan, and over here in the 2 Kings account, chapter 20, it says that there is Merodach Baladan. In other words, one of them is spelled with an M and the other one is spelled with a B. Now, you know, I don't want to make an issue about this, but I know there's always the critics of the Bible who are always trying to find some contradiction. They'd like to camp somewhere where they can just raise hell with the Bible being divinely inspired. And all I'm saying is this. You know what? It may be a copyist error. It may be a scribal error as far as one with an M and one with a B, but I kind of doubt it. And the reason I doubt it is because we all know that even in our day and age, people can have a name and they spell their names differently sometimes, and they even pronounce their names differently, or they go by a nickname or whatever. And all I'm saying is, I just throw that out there, it's the same guy, believe me. But who this person is, comes with a delegation from Babylon, and he comes down there to congratulate Hezekiah, not just because of his healing. But put it this way, the Assyrians were a threat to everyone. The Assyrians were just cruel, and they were barbaric, and they were just the most cruel and vicious people in history. I mean, they would impale people's heads on poles and decapitate their prisoners of war and stack up their skulls, you know, like they did over there like in Cambodia under Pol Pot, and they would flay people alive, skin them alive. These people were just absolutely cruel and vicious, and they had really done a number on the Babylonians. And so when all these nations heard that Hezekiah had defeated the king of Assyria, they were all delighted. Now, obviously, Hezekiah told them it was the Lord that did it, but they gave Hezekiah the credit because that's where he was defeated, yeah, right? So they all come down there and bring a big delegation to give him presents and to really congratulate him on his victory and also his healing. All right, so when you look at this... Well, go back to that latter part of that verse 1 in chapter 39, and it says, "And present to Hezekiah, for he heard that he had been sick and recovered. And Hezekiah was pleased and showed him all of his treasure house, the silver and the gold and the spices and the precious oil and the whole army that it was found in his treasuries." Now, put it this way. How did Hezekiah try to buy off the king of Assyria? Anybody remember?
Gold from the house of God.
He took out all of his gold from his palace and all the gold that was even up in the temple of the Lord. I mean, Hezekiah took all the money he could scrape together and he tried to buy off the king of Assyria. And it didn't work. The king said, "Fine, give me all your gold." And then when he took the gold, he says, "I'm still going to attack you and kill you." So he just reneged. The king of Assyria just reneged on this agreement that Hezekiah made by giving him all this money. But now, think hard, think deep. How did Hezekiah become so wealthy here? If he gave everything away.
Taxes.
The whole army out there.
There it is.
Killed.
Yeah. There it is. He got the entire spoil of the Assyrian army because there was hardly any of them left, and the king had hightailed it out of there with a few men he had left. They couldn't drag with them all the gold and the silver and all the spoils that the Assyrians had accumulated through knocking the snot out of one nation or one city or one village after another, right? So he not only got all of his gold back from the temple that he got all his gold back that he paid personally from his own palace treasury, but then he got all the gold and all the silver and all the precious stones and all the wealth and all the spoils from all the other people that the Assyrians had basically robbed, right? So he got it all. So now he's got all this treasury, and look what he does. He does a foolish thing, because now Hezekiah is, I think sometimes when he was low, he was really close to God. Now he's riding high. And now I think it's a dangerous place to be, because he's not showing a lot of wisdom here. And you tell me, think hard, think deep. What was so foolish about him showing all this treasury to these people of Babylon? And he was doing it out of pride.
Well, you just said the key word, Babylon. These are the Babylonians who would later come in and come back at them.
Yeah, yeah. Now, think hard, think deep. How can we apply this spiritually when it comes to our own treasures? Now, I'm not talking about, you know, the 50 cents you have in your piggy bank. I'm talking about your spiritual treasures.
All a gift of God.
Well, maybe I didn't ask this question right. Remember what Jesus said. Listen, listen. When you pray, how do you pray? Where do you go to pray?
In your own private place.
He said, don't be like the scribes and the Pharisees and the Sadducees who are out there to pray in public in these long prayers. And what's their motive?
To be seen.
And in a way, they're exposing their treasures, spiritual treasures, right? Jesus said, hey, man, go in your closet. Go in your inner room where nobody sees but your Father. Now, that's your hidden treasure. That's your spiritual treasure. He says, when you give alms, don't go out there, blow a trumpet, and just give all this money so that you can be seen. Because he's telling them right now, you have your reward. I'm telling you right now, you have your reward, right? He said, man, don't let your right hand know what your left hand is doing. That's your spiritual treasure. He says, when you fast, he says, don't wear a long face and let everybody know how miserable you are and then make everybody else miserable around you. Wash your face, comb your hair, brush your teeth. Don't let anybody know what you're doing, because that's your spiritual treasure. That's your hidden life. That's your root. Don't expose that. You only expose it for a very, very good reason and to the right people, right? Because otherwise, you're just going to end up being bankrupt. Did we get to say that?
Was that, I think what Kevin said is also very applicable, just in terms of all the gifts, all the skills and abilities we've been given are also a gift from God, and that's His grace, and spiritual gifts and those things. And if we use those and then pride ourselves on those things, then it's not giving glory to God.
Very good point.
Like King Herod, when he didn't give glory to God, and then he died because of all the worms that destroyed his body. So, like, that was... not giving God the glory.
Right. Good. That's a good point. Okay, and then verse 3, chapter 39 of Isaiah, we're going to wind this down. Then Isaiah the prophet came to King Hezekiah and said to him, "What did these men say, and from where have they come to you?" And Hezekiah said, "They have come to me from a far country, from Babylon." And he said, "What have they seen in your house?" So Hezekiah answered, "They have seen all that is in my house. There is nothing among my treasuries that I have not shown them." Then Isaiah said to Hezekiah, "Hear the word of the Lord of hosts. Behold, the days are coming when all that is in your house and all that your fathers have laid up in store to this day will be carried to Babylon. Nothing will be left, says the Lord. And some of your sons who will issue from you, whom you will beget, will be taken away, and they will become officials in the palace of the king of Babylon." Then Hezekiah said to Isaiah, "The word of the Lord which you have spoken is good." For he thought, "There will be peace and truth in my days." Now, just winding this down, it was Isaiah the prophet but went to Hezekiah the king. He says, "Hey, where are these guys from?" He says, "Well, they're from Babylon." He says, "What did you show them? What did you tell them?" He says, "Well, I showed them everything." And then Isaiah just says, "You know what? There's coming a day when all this is going to be carried off to Babylon." Now keep this in mind, okay? When the Assyrians came down, they came down around 722 BC, and they just completely destroyed the northern kingdom of Israel because of their wickedness. And then they murdered these people, and then they incarcerated them away into slavery and sold them in slavery or whatever, the ones that survived. But then it was around 689. In other words, it was over 100 years later that the Babylonians end up destroying the southern kingdom because of their wickedness. And here's my point, obviously, is that God, he's no respecter of persons. The people in Jerusalem at that time, when they were destroyed, they just felt like, well, God's temple is here, and he's never going to destroy us. But again and again, God warned them. He warned them through your prophets. Say, listen, it doesn't matter. If you are going to defy me and break my moral laws and my statutes and my ordinances and forsake me and basically give me your collective middle finger, you are going to get destroyed. I don't care how powerful you think you are or how much you think that I won't do it. I'm going to do it. And that's where this nation has gotten to this day. This nation has forgotten God. And of course, if you stuck a microphone in everybody's face in this nation, 90% of them almost will tell you they're Christian and they believe in the Bible. But the question is, are you living for God, or are you trampling underfoot his moral laws? And I tell you right now, if we're living in fornication or adultery or homosexuality, or if we're promoting pro-choice, if we're living a life that's characterized by lying and cheating and stealing and conniving, hey, I got news for anyone that's doing that, including myself. You're not going to see heaven. And God's judgment is going to come down like a ton of bricks on a nation that practices this, regardless of how many times they try to convince themselves that this nation and God are tight. Because that's exactly what happened throughout history. And I don't want to beat this to death or get on a soapbox about it. But my point is this, that he said these treasures are going to be taken away. And that's exactly what happened when Nebuchadnezzar came down and he destroyed it. But look at that verse 5 in conclusion. It says, "And Isaiah said to Hezekiah, hear the word of the Lord of hosts." Now, that phrase, Lord of Hosts, you see that constantly in the Bible. As a matter of fact, I'm teaching another Bible study on Tuesday morning, going through Zechariah. That phrase, the Lord of Hosts, is mentioned like no less than 52 times in that book of Zechariah. Now, what does that phrase mean? Because God constantly refers to himself as the Lord of Hosts. I mean, it's just literally dozens and dozens and dozens of times.
It's the angels.
Yeah, what is a host?
How many is a host?
Yeah, it's a multitude. In other words, this is the thing. This is the thing. This is the Lord of hosts, plural. The host of what? The host of stars and galaxies and planets, of insects and birds and fish and men and angels and devils, and throw it out there. He's the Lord of hosts. He's the Lord of all. You see what I'm saying? He's this Lord that we just read about in the previous chapter, about how he could reverse the entire universe, to reverse time. And nobody can feel a thing. Is that powerful? Oh, that's the Lord of hosts. That's what that is. That's who's talking right here, right? And then now, verse 6, "Behold, the days are coming when all that is in your house and all your fathers have laid up in store to this day will be carried to Babylon. Nothing will be left, says the Lord." This is the Lord of hosts. He's spoken, right? Now, unfortunately, look what happened, because in the concluding verse, well, look at verse 7 and 8. It says, "And some of your sons, whom will issue from you, whom you will beget will be taken away, and they will become officials in the palace of the king of Babylon. Then Hezekiah said to Isaiah, the word of the Lord which you have spoken is good, for he thought there will be peace and truth in my days. Now, Hezekiah is the only human. He's got feet of clay, but this is kind of disappointing to me that this was his attitude. You could distill it down, or paraphrase it by just saying that Hezekiah said, well, at least it's not going to happen in my day. And just flip a coin and walk off and say, hey, you know, everything's going to be fine with me. But jump over to that chapter 38 and look at that verse 17. Now look at how he's concerned for himself. This is, I don't know, we can all fall in this category, right? Verse 17, lo, for my own welfare I had great bitterness, right? That's what he's talking about when he was praying on his behalf. But then you jump over to this verse 8 of this chapter 39. Look at his attitude. He says, the word of the Lord which you have spoken is good, for he thought there will be peace and truth in my days. Now, you know, I'm sure that we could all make that kind of mistake, but it's just unfortunate that he didn't step back and look at this and just say, man, that's sad. That's really sad.
It doesn't even look like he didn't register what he said.
Oh, I think it did. I think it did. But see, this is the thing that I think is, it says a lot about us sometimes. I remember reading a story a long time ago about General Booth of the Salvation Army. He was out there constantly trying to win souls, and somebody had written him a letter one time and says, you know, I'm out there all the time witnessing, and I can't seem to get anywhere with anybody. And then General Booth wrote back to him and says, try tears. Have you ever read that story? Anyway, what did he mean by that? Try tears.
Empathy for people who are suffering.
Well, in other words, we can say, "Oh Lord, save the whole world." Yawn. Right. Right. But now,
symbol syndrome.
You really love somebody, and you're really grieved, and you're tore up. That they are just living in defiance of God and on their way to hell. They're making all kinds of poor choices. They're into drugs. They're hanging out with the wrong crowd. They're just doing one criminal activity after another. And let's say it's your son or it's your daughter. Or let's just say it's somebody you really care for. Now you're tore up. Now you're going to be praying with tears. Big difference, mm-hmm. Right? We could pray for ourselves with tears a lot. That's easy. That comes natural. But try praying with tears for others. You know, it's a totally different thing. But that's what will move God.